right, friends. Greg Kokel here on Stand to Reason. And I want to spend, I think, this entire show just talking about one thing. And it's something that's really, really important and almost never gets talked about as such. And consequently, I think a lot of Christians have some false notions about this issue. What I'd like to do is I'd like to talk about the soul. And I think it's important for a number of reasons. For example, just recently I spoke at, where was it, George Mason University in the Washington, D.C. area, and I gave a talk on the story of reality. And during that talk, I mentioned that, as I do in the book, of course, that human beings are special, and I talk about humans having a physical self and a non-physical self. They have a soul, but it's not having a soul that makes humans special. It is the kind of soul we have. And in fact, all sentient creatures have souls. Animals have souls. You mean Fido has a soul? Yes, Fido has, it's a very small soul, but Fido has a soul. What about Fluffy? Does Fluffy, yes, Fluffy has a soul. It's a very stupid soul. I have three stupid souls roaming around my own home on a regular basis. But yes, Fido and Fluffy and all sentient creatures have souls. And this, by the way, I mentioned this to the audience, is the not only the teaching of the story, that is, the Bible teaches this to be the case, but it has also been held by the church from the beginning. And it's not unusual then for me to get a question from somebody about that issue. Wait a minute. Animals have souls. Yep. Wait a minute. Well, then animals must go to heaven then. Nope. At least not on my view. And the reason I don't think they go to heaven is because I have no reason to think they go to heaven. That is, animal souls, as far as we can tell, do not survive the death of their bodies like human souls do. And there's a number of reasons why, that I'll get to in a bit, why we think that's the case about humans. But those reasons don't apply to animals. So this, it was a woman who had asked some questions about the soul and animals and heaven, and it was very disconcerting to her, first of all, that animals had souls at first. What biblical references say that is what she asked. I never heard that before, which I'm not surprised she's never heard that before, because this kind of thing isn't really discussed. But it is taught in the Bible. In fact, the very same words, pardon me, that are used for the soul in the Old Testament and the New Testament, words like nephesh and ruach in the Old Testament, or psyche in the New Testament, and used of humans, also are used of animals. Genesis 1:30, for example, Ecclesiastes 3:21, Revelations 8:9. All of these are places where there's a reference to the souls of animals. And then there's a whole philosophic angle to this. I have a master's degree in philosophy of ethics, philosophy of religion and ethics, and a big part of my education has to do with the so-called mind-body problem, and that is there a mind in the body? That's the problem. And there are different views on this, but one of the, I will offer you some of those reasons, and of course, all the reasons that we have for believing that humans have souls turn out to be equally reasons for sentient creatures, that is, creatures that have sentience or awareness, that experience awareness, they have souls as well, because awareness is a soulish characteristic. It is not a characteristic of matter. So So anyway, what kind of stood out for me with this woman that I was talking to at the university after the talk was the incredulity that she expressed regarding animal souls, and the biblical support for that, and then the notion that, well, if animals have souls, they must go to heaven, and her incredulity then when I said that I don't think they do. So what this demonstrates, though, is something that J.P. Moreland pointed out long, long ago, the philosopher from Talbot University, who has written a lot on the soul. In fact, I have his little booklet here that's published by RZIM, and the title is a series of booklets on a whole bunch of issues, so you can kind of get a quick study on this. But the title of this one is What is the Soul? Recovering Human Personhood in a Scientific Age. This is part of the RZIM Critical Questions booklet series, but this one written by J.P. Moreland goes into some detail about the various issues. So what J.P. has pointed out is that our understanding of the soul is so thin that when we say animals have souls, we immediately presume they must go to heaven because the only purpose of a soul is to go to heaven. And this of course shows that, you know, our understandings need to be buttressed with more information. And since I have met JP and been influenced by his own teaching on these things, I have actually given much more conscious awareness or conscious intention to the development of my own soul. Remember, Paul says in 1 Timothy, I believe, physical exercise, which I do, he says, so I go to the gym, I go to the pool, you know, I swim and whatever. Physical exercise profits little. Well, okay, it profits a little, but by contrast, godliness is a means of great gain, for it holds a promise not just for this world, but also for the life to come. Now, that's a statement that, okay, if you want to, you're going to pump iron or do whatever you do, jog, run, swim, whatever, okay, fine. But keep in mind, though you're keeping your body healthy, it's only good for this lifetime, not for the next one. Pumping iron won't make any difference in the next life. But I tell you what will, whatever discipline that you accomplish in spiritual things strengthens the soul, which survives the death of this body and benefits us in the future. So when I got kind of a clearer picture of this, and I began to think more carefully about the soulish dimension of my life, of persevering through hardship and difficulty, because it has an impact on my soul, through developing virtue in my life, because it has an impact on my soul, that those things are like pumping iron for the soul, and the benefit that I gain will not be lost in the long term, but will be there forever. So I'm not against working out. Like I said, I do it, but for temporal reasons, not for eternal reasons. I also attend to the development of my soul, which, by the way, the scripture has a lot to say about, because of the eternal benefit. Think of this, and maybe I'm getting ahead of myself a little bit, but think of this. 2 Corinthians chapter 4, verses 16 through 18, Paul makes a very important statement about eternal things and their relationship to this life. And it's a passage that I have reflected on frequently. Here's what he says. Therefore, he's talking about the resurrection first, that he who raised the Lord Jesus will raise us also with Jesus and will present us with you, Corinthians. And so in the context, knowing that there's a resurrection, Paul writes, therefore, we do not lose heart. But though our outer man is decaying, that's our physical body, yet our inner man is being renewed day by day. And then he adds this very famous passage. For momentary light affliction, which are odd words for Paul to use, because even in this book, he describes his significant suffering, okay? Whips, beatings with rods, being stoned in Lystra, shipwreck, etc., etc., etc. But he sees this as momentary light affliction compared to something. He says, for momentary light affliction is producing. So it's the affliction that's having a certain consequence. Momentary light affliction is producing for us an eternal weight of glory far beyond all comparison. While we look not at the things which are seen, but at the things which are not seen. Our physical bodies are seen, our spiritual selves are not. For the things which are seen are temporal, but the things which are not seen are eternal. So the focus on the reality of our soul and the consequences in eternity for attending to those, to the health of our soul here, are infinitely more significant than the consequences to attending our physical body, to our physical body here. That's an encouragement, certainly to me, and I hope to you, to attend more to soulish growth and soulish development and soulish integrity and soulish strengthening. Okay, so the reason that I think that's what I want to talk about here, all right, the soul, and I've already let on why I think it's kind of important. But I think there's confusion in a lot of people's minds about this. Let me tell you why this matters, or why it ought to matter, not just to us, but to everybody. Because it turns out that the nature of being human entails having a soulish self that has consequences in lots of different ways. Look, if we don't have a soul, you know, Christianity's sunk. Just saying here, because if there's no soul, then there's no afterlife, or there's nothing to go. The issue of the afterlife is irrelevant, even if there is one for something. It isn't for us if there's no soul. Because the soul is what goes to the afterlife after our physical bodies die, right? And if there's no afterlife, there's no final reckoning of justice. And if there's no final reckoning of justice, then there's no hell or punishment and no heaven or reward. And if there's no heaven or hell, then there's nothing to be saved from and there's nothing to be saved to. And if there's nothing to be saved from or to, there's no need of a Savior, right? So therefore, Jesus claims to be the Savior, either saving us from hell and or saving us for heaven, are empty, false, and Christianity is gutted of its most important feature. And that means me and all the rest of the Christians wasting our lives. I'm sorry. It means all the rest of the Christians are wasting our lives if there is no soul. So, well, that's one of the reasons it's important, because it's tied directly to the foundation of the Christian worldview. And so that's why it's good for us to be able to defend the notion, since a lot of atheists are materialists, actually most of them, almost every one of them. And to be a materialist means that you believe we're meat all the way down and there is no soul, and there are all kinds of ramifications for that. But one of the ramifications is that Christianity is false. So this is part of the challenge that we face as followers of Christ. So let me talk about what a soul is. I had a 7-year-old caller many years ago that used to call the show and ask me hard questions. And I had to think about how I can explain this to a youngster these more difficult issues. It was I loved the calls. It was a good exercise. But one of the questions he asked is, what is a soul? And I thought about it for a second, and I realized probably the best way to describe what a soul is that a soul is your invisible self. It is the part of you that is invisible, but still you. And then I told him, well, you know, since that's a little bit hard to understand, I want you to think of it this way. Your soul wears your body, so to speak, similar to the way a hand wears a glove. And I asked him, did he ever go up to the snow? Now, in Southern California, that's the way we talk about going up in the mountains where there is snow during the winter. We're going to go up to the snow because the snow's not down here. It's up there. You ever go up to the snow? And he said, yes. I said, did your mom give you gloves or your dad? Did they put your hand in gloves? He said, yes. I said, well, if you put your hand in the glove, I want you to think of your glove kind of like your body and your hand kind of like your soul. And it's the hand in the glove that makes the glove move. And in the same way, this is how your soul in your body makes your body move. Now, I asked him, what happens when you remove your hand from the glove? He said, well, the glove just lays there. And I said, the same thing happens to a body when the soul leaves. It just lies there. It's dead. And I also added two other clarifications. And one is, first, that souls aren't actually in bodies in exactly the same way that a hand is in a glove, because our hands are physical, but our souls are not. Souls are invisible, but they're still real, is what I told the young man. The second thing I said is that if we wore gloves all the time and never took the gloves off, some people might say that we didn't really have any hands at all because they never saw them. Now, of course, this would be a mistake. Because when I explained to him, when we look closely at gloves, at what they are, it becomes really clear that gloves would not be able to do the things they do all by themselves. Hands do the things that gloves alone can't do. And in the same way, souls do things that mere physical bodies can't do. Okay, and this is really key here. So when I talk about the soul here, I am talking about your invisible self that is also your essential self. That is, your soul is you. It's what you are aware of when you introspect, when you start thinking, in a sense, internally. It's the seat of your first person experiences. I'm a me, I'm a ego, I'm a self, I'm a soul. You're not just a body. You are, or maybe it might be that you have a body. That might be a better way of putting it. There's different ways of describing it. But the soul is the source or the container of all of our mental activities. So every one of our sensations or our thoughts or our beliefs or our desires, or our acts of will, all of these things are features of a self. They are not features of something that is merely physical. So far I'm just describing or defining the soul. I'm not arguing for it, but it's good to at least get a fix on what we're talking about. Now, the quickest way that I have to explain to somebody or to make the case, I guess is better, that there is a soul, to kind of rock them out of their physicalism, is physicalism being the point of view that only physical things exist. If you're a physicalist, of course, you don't believe in the soul. Atheists don't believe in the soul. They believe in the physical stuff because they have access to all the physical stuff with their five senses. But what I want to suggest to you is there's more than five senses. There are five senses that pertain to physical things. We have five ways that we can, in a certain sense, reach out and touch the physical world. We can touch them. We can hear it. We can taste it. We can smell it. We can see it. That's five. I think I got them all. But there are other senses that we have. We have other faculties that allow us to sense or be aware of certain things. We have moral faculties. This is how we know right from wrong. We have a sensory capability that is moral. So just like we can see a table, we can also see morality. By the way, if we couldn't see morality, and when I say see in this sense, I'm not talking about see with the eyes. I'm talking about seeing with this other sense. If we couldn't see morality, if there isn't a faculty that allows us to behold it in some accurate sense, we would never be able to raise the challenge to Christianity based on the problem of evil. Because evil is not simply the visual access that we have to certain events. What evil is an assessment of those events that we might see or hear. So our physical senses give us one type of data, but that isn't the kind of data that allows us to make moral assessments. There is something else going on. We can see that that action was wicked or that action was evil, or we could see that that was an act of goodness, a kindness that someone did that gives it a virtuous quality. These are all perceptions that we have. So I'm just opening the door for you now, if you haven't thought about it, to a different kind of sense that all of us have and all of us use all of the time. This is a standard feature of being human. And we're so immersed in it, it is so constant in our life that we don't think about it so much. It's like asking a fish what it's like to be wet, you know. They're always wet. And so it never occurs to them what wetness is like as such. And by the same token, we are immersed in our conscious experiences of the world. And so we don't usually look more carefully about the nature of those experiences. But what I'm saying is, in addition to physical capabilities we have to assess the world, we have non-physical capabilities as well. We have other senses. And indeed, I would argue, and I don't know if I can develop this in this hour, but even the awareness of our physical senses is a soulish awareness. It is our souls that use the physical capabilities that we have, the five senses, than to be aware of qualities that we either see, touch, smell, taste, or hear. I ought to write these down so I can get them. But here's an exercise that I will do with an audience. I've done it many, many, many times. And it's very simple, just takes a few minutes. But it's meant to rock people out of their skepticism about the existence of the soul, because they don't know what to make of this when I run them through this exercise. It's actually quite simple. Here's what I have them do. I say, I want you to close your eyes, and I want you to imagine your mother or your father, let's not be sexist about this, at the sink doing dishes, all right? And I want you to pay attention to what you see, and I want you then to tell me what color shirt is that person wearing. Actually, I usually say mother. So what color shirt is your... Do you see your mother washing dishes? Great. What color shirt is she wearing? That's my question. I say, okay, open your eyes. And then I ask people. And then they give me the answer around the room. You know, yellow, red, white, whatever it happens to be. Okay, but then I ask the question that matters. Where was that thing that you saw? Where was that? You saw it, You saw it with enough clarity that you could tell me the color of shirt your mother was wearing. Where was that? I'll tell you one thing, one place it wasn't. It wasn't in your brain, all right? Because I could have, in principle, cracked open your brain when you were doing this exercise with me, and I wouldn't have seen your mom in there in front of a sink washing dishes with a yellow blouse. It's not going to happen because she's not in your brain. In fact, the color is not, this also demonstrates that a color is not a wavelength of light. Certain wavelengths of light may cause the sensation of color in our minds, but the color isn't the wavelength, because there's no wavelength of light in your brain. When your eyes are closed, you could be completely blinded. You could have your eyes taken out, and you could still accomplish the exercise that I just offered. So where was that? And I'll tell you where it was. It was in your mind. It was the place in your soul where you could visualize certain things. And it's not just your visual capabilities that you could reproduce in your mind in a non-physical place. It turns out that you could reproduce every piece, something from every one of your five senses. So you could smell a rose, you could feel fur, you could taste a strawberry, you can hear Beethoven's Fifth. And of course, when I say that to the audience, I ask them, how many just heard it? Dun-dun-dun-dun. People are smiling. They're raising their hand. They heard it where? Not in their ear. They heard it in their souls. Now, the sensation that we reproduce in our souls is not as vivid when that sensation is created by one of our physical senses, but it's there nonetheless. These are very real things. Now, by the way, I do this exercise with people to give them an opportunity to focus in that moment with me on a soulish activity. But you don't need to do the exercise because, in a sense, you're doing the exercise all the time. The soul is the thing, your soul, is the thing you are most aware of most of your life. Every waking moment, you are experiencing the external world through your internal self, your invisible self, that uses your body to access the rest of the world. However, it seems pretty clear that even apart from your body, and there's a lot of evidence for this, I'll speak of in a moment, but even apart from your body, when your soul is not in your body, so to speak, and of course, you know, I just mentioned a moment ago that the soul is not in the body like a pea is in the pod, like the hand is in the glove. It's united with your body, but when it is disunited, and this happens sometimes, in what are called NDEs or near-death experiences, because generally, not always, but generally, these kinds of separations of the soul from the body happen as a result of trauma. Well, in that case, the souls have all kinds of sensory capabilities, even though there's no physical body there to communicate the information to their souls. Now, I mentioned NDEs, and I said I'd give you some examples. I'm just going to speak generally here. I'm just looking right now in the bookcase over there. J.P. Moreland and Gary Habermas wrote a book called Immortality. I think it's been published twice, and I think that's the second title. Is that right? What is it? Amy's got... Well, Beyond Death, I think, was the first title, and then I think Immortality was the second. Well, it's one of those two things. Maybe it is Beyond Death. Okay, but anyway, in that book, they of course, one's an expanded version of the other. I can't remember which one's which, but Immortality or Beyond Death. And Gary Habermas's chapters talk about near-death experiences. And in the updated version, he gives more detail, and that came out about 15 years ago or more. And since then, there has been an avalanche, a tsunami of clinical evidence for NDEs. And when I say NDE here, I'm talking about experiences that people have when they are not united with their body. They're on the operating table. They have loss of life clinically or technically. That is, their heart stops beating and they have a flat EKG and a flat EEG. I get them mixed up. But everything's flat. Nothing's working. The person's dead. Or I should say, the body is dead. But the person, the self, the soul is somewhere else. How do we know it's somewhere else? Because they can tell us after they return. I went somewhere else. Well, where did you go? I went down the hall. I went across the street. I went across town. And when I did that, I saw something there. And here is what I saw. And then plenty of detail. And then, whoosh, I'm back in my body again. I'm back in the hospital or at the crash scene or whatever. But now they are able to describe what they experienced when their soul was not with their body. You see, by the way, how this is evidential. In other words, you can test whether or not those things they said happened actually took place when their body was in the operating room or at the crash site or whatever. And therefore, you can find out whether their testimony is veridical or not, whether it's truthful. And time and time and time and time again, it has been shown that the person has detailed knowledge of events away from where their physical bodies were, and events for which they could never have had this detailed information unless they were there observing it in a soulish kind of way. Now, these events are called remote viewing, and there are gazillions of documented cases of this. I am not using these examples here of remote viewing to argue for the existence of heaven. A lot of people have used NDE experiences to try to make the case for heaven. Whether that's valid or not is a different issue. I'm not addressing it here. All I'm doing with NDEs is making a case that the soul and the body are separate. And the reason we know they're separate is because they can be separated. And we can see the body here, and the soul is aware of something over there that we can test regarding and demonstrate it to be so. So near-death experiences, particularly those with occasions of remote viewing, certainly tell us something important about what it means to be human, even if it doesn't necessarily give us reliable information about what happens after death. We certainly know that the soul and the body are distinct. And that's one powerful piece of evidence that actually has a connection there to science. So we can use scientific kind of details, information, at least to tell us that the physical body is not alive. But even if there's a little beep, beep, beep somewhere along in the physical body, the information being given to us from the person's soulish experience elsewhere shows us that even if you got a little life in the body, the soul's not there. Now, I don't know that there is life in the body if the soul's not there. I think it's not. But I'm just saying, even though there might be, if somebody wanted to point that out, it doesn't in any way disqualify this particular issue. So the biblical worldview is that human beings are not meat all the way down. There's a rational, invisible self, a soul, or a mind, if you will, or spirit, if you will, that is united with the body, and that's the natural state of affairs. However, death or other experiences can cause this disunification, and it's possible to evidentially demonstrate that this has actually taken place. So what I'm trying to do here is I'm trying to give you some good reasons that are not necessarily biblical, theological, religious, that there is a soul. And I've cited, first of all, examples of remote viewing and suggested a source that you can go to for it. And as one evidence for the existence of a soul, I also gave you a reflective exercise that anyone can do that just recreates a process that you go through all the time but never think so much about it, about how you can have access to an invisible realm that is not anywhere in your physical body. And I had the exercise of reflecting on your mother, you know, washing dishes and the color of blouse that she wore. So there's the second kind of evidence for that. Now, what a lot of people want to do, that let's just set those aside for the moment, though I think these are powerful and compelling. And when people offer what I'm going to offer in just a moment as a way of denying the soul and arguing that that everything can be explained adequately simply by an appeal to physical activity in the brain. These two illustrations are examples to the contrary. But there's another line of thinking here, and this is a philosophical line of thinking. And I want to introduce that line of thinking to you by offering you, what Leibniz, the philosopher, called the law of the indiscernibility of identicals. I know that's a mouthful, but I spent a lot of money to be able to talk like that, so I got to use it once in a while. But it actually is a fancy philosophic phrase that means something very simple. If you have two things that are actually metaphysically identical to each other, then there is no difference between the two because there aren't two but one. So let me give you an example of that. What if I said that Greg Kokel is identical to the president of Stand to Reason? Would that be a true statement? Yes, it would. Because the word is here is being used as an is of identity. There are actually five different ways to use the word is. There are common ways that we use it in language. It's not a philosophical trick, but this is called is of identity. That means that Greg Kokel is identical to the one who is president of Stand to Reason. And if I'm identical to the president of Stand to Reason, there are not two here, but we're just talking about the same thing under a different description. Therefore, everything that is true of Greg Kokel is also true of the president of Stand to Reason, if we are, in fact, identical, if we are the same. In fact, you could take it further and say, not only is everything that is true of one is true of the other, but everything that is possibly true of one would be possibly true of the other as well, because we're not talking about two, we're talking about one, when we're talking about metaphysical identity. Now, here's why this is an important thing to keep in mind. And again, there's nothing controversial about the law of the indiscernibility of identicals. Two things that are identical are not two things, they're one thing. So there's no differences between the two of them, right? That's all I'm saying. Now, here's the question. Am I and the activities, my mental activities, are they the same thing as my physical body? Am I identical with my physical body? As are my mental experiences and states, my thoughts, my intentions, my acts of will, my sensations, are they the same thing as my physical body? There's a lot of people who think they are. Sam Harris, one of the new atheists, is also got a PhD in this issue, right? And he thinks we're physical. That's it, top to bottom. There is no soul. Now, I think that he's wrong for a number of reasons, and I gave you two already, but I want to give you a third one that's based on the idea of the indiscernibility of identicals. If I and my states, mental, etc., my sensation, if these are the same thing as my brain and my physical body, then everything that is true about my brain and my physical body should also be equally true about my mental states and my sense of awareness, and vice versa. But that's not the case. For example, I'm having a thought now about the fact that this show has gone on for 40 minutes and 49 seconds and counting. Is that thought physical? Does that thought extend in space? Does that thought weigh something? Does that thought have chemical properties to it? Well, it seems that all of those are the wrong kinds of questions to ask about thoughts, because thoughts are not characterized by any of those things. Thoughts have propositional content, but no physical thing has propositional content. Therefore, my thoughts are not the same thing as anything physical. Therefore, my thoughts are not physical. And it's a very small step to go from the fact that my thoughts, or you could just keep going, by the way, with all kinds of mental activities, to realize that there's the thoughts and the activities that are non-physical are held in a non-physical space, if you will, for lack of a better word, or maybe place is a better word. They're in a non-physical place. They are possessed by a non-physical thing called myself, my soul. Now, there may be, in fact, there is, a relationship between my soulish activity and my physical activity. Somebody might say, every single time when you think about that thing, then this little nerve deal happens, and you can measure that kind of thing. Every time you think of this, then this part of your brain glows. Oh, well, that may be true. That is, there's a constant correlation between my mental activity and my physical brain states. But that doesn't mean my mental activity is my brain state. It just means they're constantly correlated. They certainly aren't identical. How do I know? Because they have different characteristics. My brain states have physical characteristics, but my mental states do not have physical characteristics. In fact, there's something else kind of lurking in the background that might have occurred to you. Remember I said, I made the comment like physicalists would do, every time you think about this thing, this other part of your brain glows. Here's my question. How do they know I'm thinking about that thing causing my brain to glow? I'm not talking about the causal relationship. I'm just talking about how do they know that I'm thinking that thing? And then that correlates with my brain glowing in this particular way when they put it on the right kind of equipment. How do they know that? There's only one way they can know it. They can't see the thought. There's no equipment that could tell you anything about your thoughts. All of those scientific assessments that show that different things happen in your brain when you have different kinds of thoughts and different parts of your brain are involved with different types of thoughts, all of those require that someone has given a personal report. In other words, they can't see the thoughts. They have to ask me, what are you thinking about? Well, I'm thinking about my kids who I love. And while I'm thinking about my kids who I love, boom, this thing glows on the meter or whatever. But I have to report that. You know why I have to report it? Is because my own mental experiences are first person private. Nobody else, even in principle, has access to my own mental experiences. I'm the only one that has any access to that. And if you want to know about my mental experiences, I've got to tell you. If you want to map my brain activity, that corresponds to my mental experiences, you first have to have me tell you what's going on before you can start mapping. Now, once you're mapping and you get it all mapped out, then I don't have to tell you anything. You can just kind of watch this activity, and because you already know the correlations, you could say, oh, you're probably thinking about your family right now because that same part of your brain is active. Nothing wrong with that, but notice I have to be able to do that. I have to tell you because they're first person private. You realize, of course, that no physical thing, no merely physical thing is like that. I have a pen in front of me right here. This pen is in my hand, but it's third person public. That means anything that I can see or discover about this pen, Amy Hall, on the other side of the glass here, has in principle equal access to, because all purely physical things are equally accessible in principle to everybody else. But when it comes to one's own mental states, that person is the only one who has direct access to them. That shows you, by the way, that your mental states are not physical states. You have private access to them, and for anyone to know what's going on, you have to report it. So there's another argument now for the existence of the soul, because there are certain aspects or characteristics of soulish experience that are not physical. They are in different categories. I'll tell you another thing that is true about our souls that is not true about a mere physical object. I said I'm holding the pen right here. And I could draw a bunch of conclusions about this pen. It's silver and black. It's got blue ink. It's got a push-button thing on it. It's a up-and-down deal. But it's possible I could be mistaken about that. Maybe I'm the lighting's not good. Oh, that's not blue. That's actually, wait a minute. That is black. It's not blue, the outside. It is blue ink. Yeah. Okay, so you could be mistaken about physical things. Here's what you can't be mistaken about. You can't be mistaken about the content of your own thoughts. So I can't be thinking that I'm thinking about this radio show and not be thinking about it. Now, I might be thinking that I'm on a radio show, and in fact, physically, I'm not on a radio show. It could be part of my imagination. It could be a dream or something like that. So I might be wrong about what I think, but I can't be wrong about thinking about what I'm thinking. You see my point? There's a certain incorrigibility that we have to certain aspects of our interior life. I can't be thinking about a sandwich, but be thinking I'm not thinking about a sandwich. I'm thinking about Christmas or something like that. Now, this is also something that's unique about our mental lives that is not true of physical things, like the pen that I was just talking about. So there are a number of lines of argument that we can use that are appropriate to demonstrate that there is a big difference between my physical self and my soulish self. That there are qualities my soul has, like the ability to recall sensations of my senses, like seeing your mother washing dishes or something like that, or imagining a whole host of things. You have dramas that take place. Many of you recall these at night when you dream, these dramas that take place. Where is that? In your mind. Who wrote those stories? Well, you did. Your mind wrote those stories in most cases. I guess there's a supernatural element that might be involved in some cases. But generally, these are all different activities. And you can talk all day long, if you like, about all the electrical activity that's going on in the brain when and the rapid eye movements and all the physical stuff that attend to our own experience of dreams. But none of those things are the dreams. Because the dreams don't have all of those physical characteristics. The dreams have plot and action and sensations. I mean, I have sensations in my dreams. I can see colors. I can feel wetness. I'm aware of those kinds of things, but it's all in my mind. You know, even the notion of dysphoria, that a person has dysphoria regarding that person's gender, that they may, as many people put it, be a woman in a man's body or a man in a woman's body, you realize that this makes no sense at all unless the self being described is as a different gender from the physical body is actually a real self. If you are just a physical body, that physical body has a gender, you can see by, or a sex, however you want to characterize it. But gender dysphoria is the sense that the gender someone has physically is not the gender one is mentally. So the entire project related to gender dysphoria, and I'm a woman in a man's body, et cetera, is implicitly an acknowledgement of the existence of the soul. And for some, that ought to be a clue, it seems to me. So I've talked about a number of things that about evidence for the soul. Here's one that I haven't mentioned yet. I haven't mentioned about our identity through time. I remember giving a talk many years ago at a local junior college here in Southern California, and it was about science and faith. Are they compatible? And I had a questioner challenge me about the existence of the soul, a young man. I just seemed to be about 18 or 19 or 20 years old. And so I asked him what his birthday was. He didn't know where I was going with it. I just said, what's your birthday? He said, what do you mean? I just went, well, when were you born? He said, the 1982. I said, what day? He said, June 2nd, 1982. And I said, so you were born on June 2nd, 1982. Yeah, what are you getting at? I said, is that the same body that you had on June 2nd, 1982, when you were born? No. Okay. If you were born on June 2nd, 1982, and the body you now have is not the body you had when you were born, then you are not your body, are you? Now, he didn't know what to say to that, because there's nothing to say to that. It's pretty straightforward. We are aware that we are the same ones that, inhabit, let me back up. We are the same ones who were born on our birthday. But this isn't the same body we had when we were born on our birthday. In fact, you know, some say that every 7 years, virtually every single cell of your body is replaced by something else. All the physical stuff has been replaced. But you are still you. What is it that sustains your identity through time, given the physical changes to your body? Now, some people say, well, it's my memories. Well, there you... That... For one, if you say your memories, then you're also making acknowledgement to some non-physical element of yourself, your memories. But what if you lost your memories? What if you had amnesia? Would you cease being yourself? Who is Jason Bourne? Okay, Bourne identity. Couldn't remember who he was. Does that mean he was nobody? No, of course not. Your memories aren't you. You are still yourself, even if you can't remember who you are or what you did. If all of your memories were erased, you'd still be yourself, because yourself is not your memories. Your memories are a non-physical part of yourself in a non-physical place called your soul. Your body is useful in communicating memories, if you have them, and does all kinds of wonderful things, but it changes over time. It's not the same body that you were born with. And since you were born on a certain date, but the body you have is not the same body you had when you were born on your birthday. then you are not your body. Now, there's all kinds of other ways I could argue. I've got some notes and paperwork here, you know, but I don't think all of this is really necessary. And the reason I don't think it's all really necessary is because we know better. We know we are a soul with a body. We know there is an invisible self. We are aware of that all the time. It's a fundamental feature of being human, and it is very entirely consistent with the Christian worldview. Atheism, of course, has to deny here something obvious, that we are souls. We have all kinds of soulish activity that have no physical parallel. That is, you can't reduce our soulish activity to some kind of physical properties at all. And the reason why is because they're something else. They're not the same thing. So there's a case that we could make to demonstrate to others that Christianity or Christian theism can make sense of some feature of the world that materialism cannot make any sense of at all, but must deny. But there's a more important element here. It's not just apologetics making our case for Christianity. It brings me back to where I was at the beginning. When I began to think more carefully about being a soulish self and that the soul is the repository for my spiritual experiences, my spiritual growth, my spiritual substance, my relationship with God, my virtuous behavior, the growth of my character, all of these things. When I realized more clearly that I'm not just a body, but I'm a substantial soul that has a self that will live forever, I began thinking more carefully about what that forever life would be like with the soul that I have. I began thinking more about investing in the health of this soul. Because like Paul said, physical exercise profits little, but godliness is a means of great gain, for it holds a promise not only for this life, but also for the life to come. Well, I hope that was helpful. I'm Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason. Give them heaven. Bye-bye now.